Chapter 59. There was no rest for the weary. Pitt went over 4 more cataracts. Providentially, none had a steep, yawning drop like the one that almost killed him and Giordino. The steepest drop he encountered was 2 meters, 6.5 feet. The partially deflated wallowing windbag bravely plunged over the sharp ledge and successfully ran an obstacle course through rocks hiding under roaring sheets of froth and spray before continuing her voyage to oblivion. It was the boiling stretches of rapids that proved brutal. Only after they extracted their toll and battering torment could Pitt relax for a short time in the forgiving, unobstructed stretches of calm water that followed. The bruising punishment made his wounds feel as if they were being stabbed by little men with pitchforks. But the pain served a worthy purpose by sharpening his senses. He cursed the river, certain it was saving the worst for last, before smashing his desperate gamble to escape. The paddle was torn from his hand, but it proved a small loss. With 50 kilograms, 110 pounds of equipment in a collapsing boat in addition to him, it was useless to attempt a sharp course change to dodge rocks that loomed up in the dark, especially while trying to paddle with one arm. He was too weak to do little more than feebly grasp the support straps attached to the interior of the hull and let the current take him where it might. 2 more float cells were ruptured after colliding with sharp rocks that sliced through the thin skin of the hull, and Pitt found himself lying half-covered with water in what had become little more than a collapsed airbag. Surprisingly, he kept a death grip on the flashlight with his right hand. But he had completely drained 3 of the air tanks and most of the 4th while dragging the sagging little vessel through several fully submerged galleries before reaching open caverns on the other side and reinflating the remaining float cells. Pitt never suffered from claustrophobia, but it would have come easy for most people in the black, never-ending void. He avoided any thoughts of panic by singing and talking to himself during his wild ride through the unfriendly water. He shone the light on his hands and feet. They were shriveled like prunes after the long hours of immersion. "With all this water, dehydration is the least of my problems," he muttered to the dank, uncaring rock. He floated over transparent pools that dropped down shafts of solid rock so deep the beam of his lamp could not touch bottom. He toyed with the thought of tourists coming through this place. A pity people can't take the tour and view these crystallized Gothic caverns, he thought. Perhaps now that the river was known to exist, a tunnel might be excavated to bring in visitors to study the geological marvels. He had tried to conserve his 3 flashlights, but one by one their batteries gave out and he dropped them over the side. He estimated that only 20 minutes of light remained in his last lamp before the Stygian gloom returned for good. Running rapids in a raft under the sun and blue sky is called whitewater rafting, his exhausted mind deliberated. Down here they could call it blackwater rafting. The idea sounded very funny, and for some reason he laughed. His laughter carried into a vast side chamber, echoing in 100 eerie sounds. If he hadn't known it came from him, it would have curdled his blood. It no longer seemed possible that there could be any place but this nightmare maze of caverns creeping tortuously end on end through such an alien environment. He had lost all sense of direction. Bearings was only a word from a dictionary. His compass was made useless by an abundance of iron ore in the rock. He felt so disoriented and removed from the surface world above that he wondered if he had finally crossed the threshold into lunacy. The only breath of sanity was fueled by the stupendous sights revealed by the light from his lamp. He forced himself to regain control by playing mind games. He tried to memorize details of each new cavern and gallery, of each bend and turn of the river, so he could describe them to others after he escaped to sunlight. But there were so many of them, his numbed mind found it impossible to retain more than a few vivid images. Not only that, he found he had to concentrate on keeping the windbag afloat. Another float cell was hissing its buoyancy away through a puncture. "How far have I come?" he wondered dully. "How much farther to the end?" His fogged mind was wandering. He had to get a grip on himself. He was beyond hunger. No thoughts of thick steaks or prime rib with a bottle of beer flooded through his mind. His battered and spent body had given far more than he expected from it. The shrunken hull of the hovercraft struck the cavern's roof, which arched downward into the water. The craft revolved in circles, bumping against the rock until it worked off to one side of the main stream of the river and gently grounded on a shoal. Pitt lay in the pool that half-filled the interior, his legs dangling over the sides, too played out to don the last air tank, deflate the craft, and convey it through the flooded gallery ahead. He couldn't pass out. Not now. He had too far to go. He took several deep breaths and drank a small amount of water. He groped for the thermos, untied it from a hook, and finished the last of the coffee. The caffeine helped revive him a bit. He flipped the thermos into the river and watched it float against the rock, too buoyant to drift through to the other side. The lamp was so weak it barely threw a beam. He switched it off to save what little juice was left in the batteries, lay back, and stared into the suffocating blackness. Nothing hurt anymore. His nerve endings had shut down and his body was numb. He must have been almost 2 pints low on blood, he figured. He hated to face the thought of failure. For a few minutes he refused to believe he couldn't make it back to the world above. The faithful wallowing windbag had taken him this far, but if it lost one more float cell, he would have to abandon it and carry on alone. He began concentrating his waning energies on the effort that still lay ahead. Something jogged his memory. He smelled something. What was it they said about smells? They can trigger past events in your mind. He breathed in deeply, trying not to let the scent get away before he could recall why it was so familiar. He licked his lips and recognized a taste that hadn't been there before. Salt. And then it washed over him. The smell of the sea. He had finally reached the end of the subterranean river system that climaxed in the gulf. Pitt popped open his eyes and raised his hand until it almost touched the tip of his nose. He couldn't distinguish detail, but there was a vague shadow that shouldn't have been there in the eternal dark of his subterranean world. He stared down into the water and detected a murky reflection. Light was seeping in from the passage ahead. The discovery that daylight was within reach raised immensely his hopes of surviving. He climbed out of the wallowing windbag and considered the two worst hazards he now faced: length of dive to the surface and decompression. He checked the pressure gauge that ran from the manifold of the air tank. 850 pounds per square inch. Enough air for a run of maybe 300 meters, 984 feet. Providing he stayed calm, breathed easily, and didn't exert himself. If surface air was much beyond that, he wouldn't have to worry about the other problem, decompression. He'd drown long before acquiring the notorious bends. Periodic checks of his depth gauge during his long journey had told him the pressure inside most of the air-filled caverns ran only slightly higher than the outside atmospheric pressure. A concern, but not a great fear. And he had seldom exceeded 30 meters of depth when diving under a flooded overhang that divided two open galleries. If faced with the same situation, he would have to be careful to make a controlled 18-meter, 60-foot-per-minute ascent to avoid decompression sickness. Whatever the obstacles, he could neither go back nor stay where he was. He had to go on. There was no other decision to make. This would be the final test of what little strength and resolve was still left in him. He wasn't dead yet. Not until he breathed the last tiny bit of oxygen in his air tank. And then he would go on until his lungs burst. He checked to see that the manifold valves were open, and the low-pressure hose was connected to his buoyancy compensator. Next, he strapped on his tank and buckled the quick-release snaps. A quick breath to be sure his regulator was functioning properly, and he was ready. Without his lost dive mask, his vision would be blurred, but all he had to do was swim toward the light. He clamped his teeth on the mouthpiece of his breathing regulator, gathered his nerve, and counted to three. It was time to go, and he dove into the river for the last time. As he gently kicked his bare feet, he'd have given his soul for his lost fins. Down, down the overhang sloped ahead of him. He passed 30 meters, then 40. He began to worry after he passed 50 meters. When diving on compressed air, there is an invisible barrier between 60 and 80 meters. Beyond that, a diver begins to feel like a drunk and loses control of his mental faculties. His air tank made an unearthly screeching sound as it scraped against the rock above him. Because he had dropped his weight belt after his near-death experience over the great waterfall, and because of the neoprene in his shredded wetsuit, he was diving with positive buoyancy. He doubled over and dove deeper to avoid the contact. Pitt thought the plunging rock would never end. His depth gauge read 75 meters, 246 feet, before the current carried him beneath and around the tip of the overhang. Pitt thought the plunging rock would never end. His depth gauge read 75 meters, 246 feet, before the current carried him beneath and around the tip of the overhang. Now the upward slope was gradual, not the ideal situation. He'd have preferred a direct ascent to the surface to cut the distance and save his dwindling air supply. The light grew steadily brighter until he could read the numbers of his dive watch without the aid of the dying beam from the lamp. The hands on the orange dial read 10 minutes after 5 o'clock. Was it early morning or afternoon? How long since he dove into the river? He couldn't remember if it was 10 minutes or 50. His mind sluggishly puzzled over the answers. The clear, transparent emerald green of the river water turned more blue and opaque. The current was fading and his ascent slowed. There was a distant shimmer above him. At last the surface itself appeared. He was in the gulf. He had exited the river passage and was swimming in the Sea of Cortez. Pitt looked up and saw a shadow looming far in the distance. One final check of his air pressure gauge. The needle quivered on zero. His air was almost gone. Rather than suck in a huge gulp, he used what little was left to partially inflate his buoyancy compensator, so it would gently lift him to the surface if he blacked out from lack of oxygen. One last inhalation that barely puffed out his lungs, and he relaxed, exhaling small breaths to compensate for the declining pressure as he rose from the depths. The hiss of his air bubbles leaving the regulator diminished as his lungs ran dry. The surface appeared so close he could reach out and touch it when his lungs began to burn. It was a spiteful illusion. The waves were still 20 meters, 66 feet away. He put some strength into his kick as a huge elastic band seemed to tighten around his chest. Soon the desire for air became his only world, as darkness started seeping around the edges of his eyes. Pitt became entangled in something that hindered his ascent. His vision, blurred without a dive mask, failed to distinguish what was binding him. Instinctively, he thrashed clumsily in an attempt to free himself. A great roaring sound came from inside his brain as it screamed in protest.
But in that instant before blackness shut down his mind, he sensed that his body was being pulled toward the surface. "I've hooked a big one!" shouted Joe Hagen joyously. "You got a marlin?" Claire asked excitedly, seeing her husband's fishing pole bent like a question mark. "He's not giving much fight for a marlin," Joe panted as he feverishly turned the crank on his reel. "Feels more like a dead weight." "Maybe you dragged him to death." "Get the gaff. He's almost to the surface." Claire snatched a long-handled gaff from two hooks and pointed it over the side of the yacht like a spear. "I see something," she cried. "It looks big and black." Then she screamed in horror. Pitt was a millimeter away from unconsciousness when his head broke into a trough between the waves. He spit out his regulator and drew in a deep breath. The sun's reflection on the water blinded eyes that hadn't seen light in almost 2 days. He squinted rapturously at the sudden kaleidoscope of colors. Relief, joy of living, fulfillment of a great accomplishment, they flooded together. A woman's scream pierced his ears and he looked up, startled to see the capri blue hull of a yacht rising beside him, and two people staring over the side, their faces pale as death. It was then that he realized he was entangled in fishing line. Something slapped against his leg. He gripped the line and pulled a small skipjack tuna, no longer than his foot, out of the water. The poor thing had a huge hook protruding from its mouth. Pitt gently gripped the fish under one armpit and eased out the hook with his good hand. Then he stared into the little fish's beady eyes. "Look, Toto," he said jubilantly, "we're back in Kansas.